Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
It's Monday, 3rd of July, and we're recording this podcast episode together with Galen Dahl, managing editor. My name is Wojciech Przybylski. We're heading into the Spanish presidency of the EU after Sweden handed it over to Spain. In the media, there's a lot of rumor about whether the presidency in the EU Council is still so relevant, since none of them is actually able to deliver that much. But in our case, we're focusing on things related to Central European affairs, and in this context, discuss the European and the transatlantic space. So, Galen, what we have just been focusing on in our work, monitoring the developments in security and democratic security in Central Eastern Europe?
Thank you, Wojciech. Kind of pivoting off your point about the Spanish presidency, it was kind of fascinating that his first stop on the day that Spain took over the presidency, Prime Minister Sanchez did visit Kiev and reiterated both, of course, his support and the EU support for Ukraine, but also kind of the lack of training that Ukraine is needed, especially with pilots. And this, of course, then brought up issues about ammunitions, which are in short supply from Western sources. And in the same weekend, in the same kind of, media cycle, we have the U.S. now pondering whether or not they're going to be offering cluster bombs, which have been asked for Kiev for the last several months, but haven't really been on the table. And I think this has mainly been because human rights activists have been against any kind of proliferation of these. But apart from that kind of general issue, we've seen the security situation since the failed Wagner mutiny really start to destabilize the region more and more. What do you think? Do you think that there's going to be long legs about the seriously the failed mutiny and Bajoran now being based in Belarus?
Well, I would start from asserting the things that we know and underlying the things we don't know about the whole incident from previous weekend and the Wagner Group so-called mutiny or incursion into Russian sovereign space. So on the things we know that there was an official statement by Prigozhin and Mr. Lukashenko underlying that they're going to have Wagner camps in Belarus. And while I think BBC has confirmed visually that there are some tents being put up, there is no confirmation on whether Wagner mercenaries are really relocating to Belarus. So we don't know really if this is a deception, this is a theater, or there is, in fact, a movement of mercenaries into Belarus. To play it safe, and especially ahead of the NATO summit, and Vilnius is dangerously close to Belarus border, to the Lithuania-Belarus border, is really, it's a walking distance, day distance of walk the most from the border. That gives you an impression of how even this slightest chance of instability in the neighborhood plays out for the upcoming summit, how important that is that NATO actually has special care over handling the situation, which already is tense because of the pressure on the border and migration. That is a basically smuggling / forced migration organized by Belarusian state, not just in Poland, but also in the direction of Belarus and Latvia. And it has been a pressure for the past year. So no, actually, if I'm not mistaken, it's 2 years. We can count it now 2 years since we first reported in 2021. In June. Yeah, so I just wanted to say, and just finishing on the note of Wagner, On one side, how can you imagine two alpha males in one small country like Belarus? And Lukashenko is an old wolf who wouldn't necessarily, you know, want to invite the person who may basically decapitate him politically, if not simply speaking, literally, in the near future. That's something that is still on my mind when I'm thinking about the situation. And second of all, I think that Russians still, especially in within their security systems, are masters of deception. They've been decepting themselves as well, but we should not be under any illusions that they have not resigned from deceiving the West and the world about their potential. Their attempts to cover up their real intentions is still their regular state of play. So this is why, in the assessment, we need to be extra careful. We need to take it as a real security threat, but we need to think also what may be behind it.
No, and absolutely. I mean, you think about this Latvia just recently over the weekend, because of their threat perception, have now halted all Russian visas for any visas for Russian citizens, because they can't trust the documentation that's kind of coming into their applications. And doing this at the time just before the NATO summit, of course, everyone's kind of questioned though is, Ukraine has been very blatant about what they want from the summit. And you have different NATO allies presenting, you know, more hawkish, and others being more, you know, reticent about what can be on offer. We have an interesting article coming out this week, actually, that breaks down the possibilities. But I wanted to know from you, what do you think is a realistic option that might come out of this summit next week? There's a couple of different ones that could happen, but I mean, do you think they'll be more ambitious to maybe even allow for a pathway to membership, or do you think it would be more about security guarantees?
I think we should be prepared for security guarantees. And frankly speaking, Ukraine is going to pressure hard the West no matter what. Knowing that, any sensible strategic communication diplomacy should be downplaying expectations. So we may see some of the results of the summit better than expected, but by no means that would be a membership perspective at this point. There are cases being made for future NATO membership of Ukraine, should even they achieve a ceasefire at some point. The case of the Federal Republic of Germany from the Cold War has been recalled as an example. It's possible to have a state that is not yet complete, but it's split under occupation, under actually Russian occupation. And that could be a situation to consider. But we are in a wartime right now, and no one is going to offer something on the table. At the same time, as we have repeatedly said over this podcast and a number of texts that have been published, you cannot miss the mark. Similarly, like in 2008. In 2008, NATO has failed to promise Georgia and Ukraine security guarantees, this path for membership in the future, and basically halted the process, which was seen from Russia as an invitation, as a signal of weakness. So that, I don't believe, will be repeated. There will be some progress, there will be some achievement, and there is going to be an underscore of unity for Ukraine and in support of their struggle. The other question is, what will be the other topics? What will be the topics related to NATO production, industrial, military production? What will be the topics related to Swedish membership? Whether Turkey will show any sign of a change? I think these will be equally important.
Oh, that's a good point. And also, I mean, the other issues that are obviously at the forefront in the EU and in Central Europe, as you mentioned kind of briefly, but were migration and asylum for refugees. But over the weekend or recently, Poland and Hungary once again kind of joined ranks and vetoed the EU's proposal for asylum change rights. Can you explain this? Because I think this is one thing that people don't quite understand. There's a demographic challenge facing both countries from a depleting population. Yet they're kind of adamantly, at least on the show, on the face, against kind of having more migration coming into the countries. Can you explain this, I think, a little bit? Because even myself, I'm a little confused.
That has actually caught many by surprise, that both countries, when it comes to security, are as far as it gets, and yet they're trying to present their position at the European, at the Western forum, as if there was never a quarrel and as if 2015 never ended. That was the migration. The migration has been the electoral topic back then that united both both governments, both parties, the Fidesz of Viktor Orban and Law and Justice of Jarosław Kaczyński. And indeed, that seems like a wide gap that has been covered, this distance, political distance, symbolic distance, security distance has been all covered and patchworked in a matter of, you know, literally days. Now, it's even more striking against the comments provided in German interview, in German media by Viktor Orban, who said he believes that Russia is not a danger. They cannot be called that they're committing war crimes until the war is stopped, and that Ukraine is not a sovereign state. You couldn't be further one country from another in these fundamental questions, in these fundamental positions. And then they go and rattle the sabers and achieve nothing at the EU summit. Which can be only explained in domestic politics. And in domestic politics in Poland, it turns out that PIS, based on their surveys and political sociology that they constantly examine and research, there must be enough substance to go in the direction that underscores the ideological unity with Hungary, the downplays the threat of Russia and aligns actually with Kremlin-based narratives. And this is how you can score points, apparently, in the core electorate of PIS, which also is frightening because PIS party is still the most likely to remain in government rather than as an incumbent government, rather than move away in the autumn elections. And at the same time, it is slowly moving towards the ideological positions that has been put forward by Kremlin and basically have been masterfully played by Viktor Orban, masterfully in Machiavellian terms of basically being able to completely change the society of Hungary from a pro-Western society to a society full of people who are at the very best appeasers in the context of Russia and Ukraine. And now we have Poland, where PIS is trying in a moment you could call death by thousand cuts or salami tactics or a slowly cooked frog go the very same direction. So this is what is at stake, I think. If you look at the country, I mean, Hungary is not a problem. It's a nuance in the Western alliance. But for Poland to change a position and go this direction, that would be a big, big problem, also given simply the geography and the border with Ukraine. So yes, this is where our thoughts and interests and efforts to talk to crack the foundations of this ideological alliance or axis still need to be. I do not believe that they are fundamentally there. PIS and Law and Justice are somewhere else, also thanks to the strategic culture of the people of Poland. People in both electorates strongly believe that we're against Russia, actually so much that they wouldn't care and they would overlook in the electorate of PIS this pro-Kremlin narratives. They simply do not connect the dots between Kremlin and the PIS. They do believe that, you know, whatever they say is, you know, patriotism and it's not fueled by divisive, polarized nationalism. They simply think it's how things should be to contain Russia. But in fact, the outcome of such policies are that Poland moves away from the Western common position, and it will be again if that happens with a potentiality of having elections in the EU being more divisive, more polarizing, and more disruptive because of the participation of the radical parties in the next EU parliament, and potentially of the comeback of Donald Trump in the US.
Yeah.
That may play only badly, in which Poland is sleepwalking into these problems with the current government, while Viktor Orban is actually preparing. His only bet, his main bet, is actually for all this to go upside down.
It's fascinating, and the developments will, you know, continue to go before the elections in October, or the, but no, it's fascinating as well as to see a similar shift to the right, not only in Poland and Hungary, but also in Slovakia, where they also have elections in September, and right now, you know, former strongman and populist Fico, although technically he's left. Positioned, his more authoritarian tendencies, are more predominant, and without a doubt, he's in the lead at the moment. We're keeping track of that. You know, it does fluctuate, of course, but it'll be interesting what happens in the coming months.
Yeah, Slovakia is no less important ally of within the NATO framework and in the EU. Actually, much more embedded thanks to. Eurozone membership in terms of European policies, but somehow weaker in terms of the strategic culture in terms of who Slovaks consider a challenger, to their security and identity, and who not. But that's another story we will also cover. But now let's talk about Poland and let's head for the interview.
Hello everyone, my name is Agnieszka Homańska and I'm here today with Chris Nidenthal, a British photographer of Polish descent, one of the most respected photojournalists. He worked for such magazines as Newsweek, Der Spiegel, Time, or Forbes. Chris, thank you so much for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
But speaking about your photography, of course, and a war observer, would you describe yourself as such?
I guess so. And it's very difficult after so many years of hard work, really. But I actually came to the conclusion, as it turns out, that I must be a visual historian, if not an observer, but I guess an observer as well, but a historian in the sense that everything I've shot so far has been history, really, which is a lovely way of doing it. I managed to sort of be a photographer in very interesting times.
Well, indeed. But once you said that political photos are not as important as those that document daily life, because political photos become outdated very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking about history and speaking about today's history, how does everyday life look like right now in Poland?
Poland has become, I hope to become a normal country after 1989. And it was a normal country until a certain point when we seem to be going backwards, although you can't see it on the streets. I mean, we have new shops, new underground system, new trains, new everything. Everything's new, so everything looks fine. that the system seems to be backtracking to what it used to be like in 30 or 40 years ago.
Nevertheless, you photographed many of the politically important people, moments, and you mentioned how Poland changed throughout the years. Did you know back then, when you were there on the street, that you were witnessing and recording some kind of a breakthrough?
I guess when eventually the first free elections came about in 89, I guess I must have realized that something very important was happening. When the strike started in Gdansk in 1980, I realized that was very important, because it's not often you had a big strike in a big factory or big a shipyard in this case, in a socialist or communist country. So that was pretty obvious that the very important things were happening. Same with when the wall came down in Berlin, you could see with your own eyes that something very important was happening. Or even when the Pope came, when the Polish Pope was elected and then he came to Poland in 79, that was also a very, I'd be pretty silly if I didn't realize that something very important was happening. But it's true, I do like my everyday life pictures, sort of, rather than the political pictures, in return to your previous statement, because, as you said, politicians and politics die after a certain time, whereas daily life just goes on and on. But it's just interesting to see 40 years after you've shot something of daily life, 40 years later, it becomes important, because it's a document of old days.
Well, I'd venture a guess that what you just described really makes you the aware observer. You have your camera today with you as well. Are you going with it everywhere, to every place nowadays?
Well, I wouldn't say I go with it all the time, but I'm actually in the middle of shooting. I'm trying to put together a book about Warsaw itself.
One of your most famous photo presents a Warsaw cinema called Moscow with a movie poster, Apocalypse Now, and an armored vehicle. And it was taken on the, if I'm not wrong, the first day of the martial law.
I think it was more the second day, but that's, okay. It makes no difference, of course, because we were all pretty scared in those days, because we just had no idea what was happening. We didn't know what martial law was. But yes, that was the second day of martial law.
But as you are trying to capture what's happening right now in Poland and in Warsaw, I think this photo was to some extent an allegory of those times. And what would be right now the allegory for you?
That's a difficult one, because the Apocalypse Now picture is martial law in a nutshell, because it shows Moscow and the Polish way of looking at Moscow. It shows the film, which is Apocalypse Now, which is pretty obvious, and it shows the army and the armored personnel carrier underneath. So it's all there. I mean, that's martial law in a nutshell. So that's a simple picture. Nowadays, difficult. I would have a problem to find something similar now, mm-hmm. especially as that cinema is gone.
Yeah, but it's also all about the system that we are living in. And you mentioned strikes in Gdansk,
yes,
like 30 years ago. And while talking about the allegory, the symbol of today, would demonstration, strike, people gathering on the street today right now in Poland be to some extent the symbol? Because we had the 4th of June,
yes,
we have abortion law, freedom of speech, freedom of judiciary, and I know that you are there when those demonstrations.
I cover that, so because I'm no longer active sort of commercially. I don't work for any magazines or papers or anything, or agencies. I just photograph for myself. But yes, it's true. June the 4th. Parade, or whatever you want to call it, was fantastic. But if you manage to get a good picture from above of what was happening to show the crowds, yes. But crowds don't make an iconic picture. Really, it's not the same. I think the martial law was a one-off thing because it was just so simple and so direct. Nowadays, even if I photograph all these demonstrations, they, in a way, they're all the same. Sometimes mm-hmm. bigger, sometimes smaller, sometimes very big. But I wouldn't choose that as a picture to show the Times. If I showed several pictures together of what's been happening over the last 8 years or so, then yes. But I still haven't found a picture like that in my work.
But you also, except for symbols, you also capture people and people faces, facial expressions, eyes, etc. Are those people a part of Polish civil society?
Absolutely. I mean, they're the people who are just as worried as I am about what's happening in Poland. And that's why I look into their eyes, really, if I can get close enough, look in their eyes, look at their faces. And they are a symbol, because they're a symbol of people who want, maybe freedom is not the right word, but they want a government which makes sense and is fair and law abiding, which is something we're missing right now. So I try to look for that in their faces, and it's true. I mean, the actual June the 4th march through Warsaw was just full of those faces, or very positive faces, because if you look at the faces of the ones that support the present government, those faces are actually in a way different. I'm not sure where the difference is, but they are simply more they're negative faces, whereas the opposition faces are positive faces. I mean, that's a pretty simple way of putting it. But there is in my eyes as a photographer, I see a positive look in their faces rather than the others who are there because they have to be there or whatever, God knows what, and then they look pretty sour to people who are already fighting, not physically, but fighting mentally to change the system again.
While taking photos, you are seeing the world through a lens, yeah. And it changes a little bit the perspective. You mentioned the value of civil society. Your tool as a camera. So do you think that politics should play such a role, should be a tool for the civil society, that should be to some extent the mean of creation for them?
I mean, that's a difficult question, really, because I'm not a politician and I'm not a political commentator. I'm a visual guy.
But an observer.
Observer, yes. So in a way, I see more than others, but I wouldn't delve so much into the political aspect of it all. Although it is very important, and it is what's causing all the trouble. But civil society, I mean, it's an interesting concept, really. And the interesting thing in Poland is the women who are becoming the civil society, more in a way, more than the men, which is an interesting way of looking at it, because they're really fed up with everything. They've been treated badly. They're not paid as equally as men. The abortion thing is an ongoing problem, which is very difficult to solve. Of course, there is a certain amount of power in there, and men usually shiver in front of fighting women. Mm-hmm. In fact, I can see. I remember a few years ago when the first black umbrellas. Protest took place, and the pro abortion one, and my immediate impression was that Kaczynski and his people are in trouble. I mean, this is going to break them. Of course, that was too early to say that, but I think in the long run, if that carries on, it's the women who are going to be the powerful ones. And even in politics now, if there are women who are coming into politics, and they're pretty strong and they're worth listening to. So I think the future is there.
It really reminds me of one photo of yours, the one that I personally really, really like. There is a woman that is cutting a man hair in a village yard.
Yes.
He was preparing for the elections.
To the elections, yeah. In 89, it was in a small village. And it was really, I couldn't figure out why this man was sitting in the middle of his courtyard and being his hair was being cut by probably his daughter or whatever. But only when he told me what the situation was that I realized that that's a pretty good symbol of what was happening in 1989, that it was his first free election, mm-hmm. and he wanted to be smart before he went off to put the paper in the box.
Some 40% of young Poles aged 18, 29 do not intend to cast their vote in the fall. Yeah. And on the other hand, among those over 60, the reluctant are only about 20%. So it's a big, big difference. And you think that, like, why young people don't want to vote, why they just don't feel the sense of agency, or maybe they feel disillusioned, or maybe they just simply, as you said, they don't care.
I think they just don't care. And when they look at the politicians, and the culture of politics in Poland is pretty low. They're not particularly happy to see anybody, really. I mean, whichever side the politicians are on, not many of them can hold the attention of young people who are just worried about their bank account and having a good time. So this is a big problem, of course. And a big problem, of course, is also the fact that some of the young people, especially the men, say that if they will vote, they'll vote for the far right, which is ultra right or mm-hmm. right. So we are in the middle of a voting crisis, really. And it won't be the same atmosphere as I remember in 89, because that was simply a clear cut thing between communism and freedom to a certain extent. And even though it was a difficult start, we can see now after so many years that everything worked mm-hmm. in a way okay. But right now, I think, especially the angry, but I'm surprised that the older people, over 60s, because I'm over 60, and I would certainly vote, because I just feel it's so important that we have to do something. But if people like me don't vote, then and the young people don't vote, then we have a problem.
Yeah, then
we have a problem in any case, but it's an even bigger problem.
Of course, right, then who's going to choose what the future is going to be. But okay, speaking about elections, I think 2023 is generally very important. For Europe, for the world, last month, Erdogan won again in Turkey.
Yes.
2 days ago, Greeks chose the conservative New Democracy Party again.
Yeah.
And right now, I think that the world's eyes are turned to Poland, to Slovakia, and both countries can actually follow Ankara's path.
Italy, I mean, Italy has a nice lady on top, but she does have rightist tendencies. But I think everywhere there's a problem with for some obscure reason people are returning to thinking about the far right, and which is after what happened in 1945. I mean, it's peculiar. I mean, especially America,
mm-hmm.
with Trump sort of cluttering away in the background, trying to get back into power. I mean, these are serious problems, of course, because these are people who should be completely avoided or completely pushed aside, because they will cause such big problems that, and in all the countries, I mean, even in my England, so to speak, the Brexit thing, of course, was a big I'd say it's a big mistake, of course. And I'm sure many of the Brits who voted for Brexit are now cursing themselves for having done so. But the whole world is being divided again into left and right, and the right, as it often happens, can be stronger, because they like a strong hand, of course.
But has history therefore come full circle?
I think it never comes a complete full circle, but it's hovering near a circle there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember speaking to some German people dozens or several decades ago who said that the right will never, it's gone, the far right. Germans who don't exist anymore, or if they do, it's a complete border case, borderline case. And yet, after a few years or a few decades, it turns out that it's not the case, that these things are lingering in the background and they come up at the worst possible times, of course. But exactly, I mean, things which you would imagine would never be happening before, like the far right coming to power, getting more and more power, say in Germany right now, and here as well. You'd think that would be impossible, but that was the last thing that would be possible, and it turns out that it's happening. so really, we don't know anything really.
Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'd like to be an optimist.
But the reality makes you...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is having seen so much and lived through so much, one wonders what's happening. Like my dream is that the opposition would win in a complete landslide. I mean, this is completely opposite of what the polls say and what people are saying. But it would be fantastic if it turned out that on the day of the elections and the day after we find out that it's a complete landslide victory for the opposition, which would be wonderful, of course. But that's my dream. So that in that respect, I'm an optimist, but I'm a pessimist in the sense that these things don't really work that way.
This is actually going to be my last question. Are you going to be there with your camera on the day of the Polish elections in October?
I hope so. I hope so, yes. Although elections are pretty boring for a photographer, it's not nothing much is happening. That's why even the Polish elections in 1989 were not particularly photogenic, I mean, or visual. Mm-hmm. And that's partly why the world thinks that it's when the wall came down in Berlin that it was the Germans who finished off communism and so on, completely forgetting the fact that all the hard work was done over here for decades, really. Because a wall crumbling is visual, whereas a person putting a paper in a ballot mm-hmm. box is pretty boring. So, and that's why I went in 89. I did something with Jaruzelski when he was voting in Warsaw, and then ran into the countryside to see what the countryside was looking like at the same time. And that was much more interesting, of course. But yes, I'll be there. I'll be there.
Chris, thank you so much for your time, for sharing all your views.